Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome back to New Books in Environmental Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Brian Hamilton, your host today, and I'm thrilled to be joined by Paul Sabin. He is professor of history and American studies at Yale University, where he also coordinates the Environmental History Working Group and Environmental Humanities Program. He's the author of The Bet, Paul Ehrlich, Julian Simon, and Our Gamble Over Earth's Future, and before that, Crude Politics, The California Oil Market, 1900 to 1940, He's here today to discuss his latest book, Public Citizens, The Attack on Big Government and the Remaking of American Liberalism. It was published last week by W.W. Norton. Dr. Sabin, welcome to the show.
Thanks. Thanks for having me on.
This is really a marvelous book. It's so timely, it's historiographically important, and it's really crisply written. You know, I'm a slow reader, and I read it in a day.
That's great.
And when it comes to kind of classifying it by genre or academic field, it's a little slippery. It's, you know, something kind of a mirror. I was thinking that if you were to approach it expecting another, you know, cutting edge book on environmental politics from an esteemed environmental historian, you certainly won't be disappointed. But, you know, if you pick it up caring very little about environmental scholarship, you can still, you know, still be thoroughly taken by the book. And you might actually never think to use the adjective environmental to describe it. And so I wondered, after your earlier more sort of unmissably environmental books, what led you to write this one?
Oh, that's a great question. And I mean, I think it gets to, you know, my approach to environmental history, which has always been to try to relate developments in the environmental field, I guess, broadly to broader currents in American history and American politics. And so this book really follows, I guess it's in some ways a merger of the two previous books, or it brings them together. The Crude Politics was very much about law and political economy. And then The Bet was more intellectual history of sort of the arguments between economics and biology and different approaches to thinking about the environment and resources and scarcity in the 1970s. And so after The Bet, I wanted to turn to, more towards political economy and law again. And, I was looking for characters that would allow me to explore the origins of the environmental movement in the 60s and 70s, and particularly regulation and law. So then I was searching around for how to do that, which is a challenging approach. You have all these different agencies, the acronyms, and faceless bureaucrats and faceless nonprofit. They all have faces, but lots of lawyers. Respectfully, and trying to figure out how to do that. And I had access actually here at Yale to the Natural Resource Defense Council papers, which were being here. And I was at one point thought of doing sort of an organizational biography, but that didn't seem like that would work. So I instead hooked on to Ralph Nader as a central character. He seemed like a significant enough figure to sort of be a thread through the book, although it's not at all a biography. But I used him and then these organizations and other leaders to try to flesh out the public interest movement and the environmental movement.
That's great. And we'll come back to your characters, your main characters in a moment here. But I just at the very beginning of the book, you know, growing up in the United States with a very powerful conservative movement, I don't know if you've noticed, but I sometimes have struggled to fully appreciate what it was like to live in the post-war era with this dominant liberalism. And I think a kind of a testament to that dominance is that one of the first voices who's critical of the New Deal order in your book here is John F. Kennedy, a New Deal liberal. And so I wonder if you could just orient us here, like, what should listeners think of when they hear the words New Deal order? And how could someone like Kennedy, kind of firmly in that order, how could he criticize it from within?
Well, I think New Deal order, goes back to there was a wonderful collection back that maybe it was even when I was in grad school about the New Deal order, and it was really, really about the intersection of of government, business, and labor in creating a it's not exactly a coalition, but a negotiated peace of some kind in the post-war period, and between the 1920s and 1930s through the 1970s. As historians like Richard Vitor or Tom McCraw and other historians of regulation have written, there's a period of time in which the federal government plays a kind of managerial role in the economy and uses regulation to sort of manage different industrial sectors. And that's the sort of the New Deal order that I'm talking about. And what's one of the things that's interesting about Kennedy and the Kennedy administration, sort of the beginnings of this liberal repudiation of the liberal establishment itself, is a real beginning of the questioning of that order. So Kennedy talks about it. He issues a consumer message at one point, and that's probably what you're referring to. He famously has the sort of the New Deal spirit at the beginning. In his inaugural, talks about come to Washington, work for the government, and serve the country. That's very much in the spirit of the New Deal. But then he issues this consumer message in which he really acknowledges that the government is not adequately representing citizens and consumers, and there needs to be some other mechanisms for doing that. And that builds on a very important report that was written by a guy named James Landis, who I think is a great indicator of the shift within liberalism, because Landis was a New Dealer who was involved in launching the Securities and Exchange Commission, and he wrote a very important book in the 1930s, I think it came out in 1938, called The Administrative Process, in which he celebrates executive agencies and the power of executive agencies to kind of in the calm of expertise and bureaucratic decision-making to sort of act in the public interest. That New Deal approach of favoring agencies, also symbolized by the Tennessee Valley Authority, perhaps best, most vigorously, is in many ways a critique of courts and litigation and even Congress, and instead seeing agencies as a key independent source of expertise and decision making. So Landis, after that, actually goes and works for the airline regulators, and he becomes very disillusioned and realizes that the airline board has been captured by the airline companies. And then Kennedy asks him to write a report about regulatory agencies that comes out in 1960. And in that report, Landis really lays the groundwork for the public interest movement that's going to follow by describing essentially industry capture of the agencies and the ways that agency bureaucrats are representing the agencies that they're supposed to be regulating, and instead of representing some public interest. And so Landis has become very disillusioned with the agency model that he helped establish and articulate, and that sort of lays the groundwork for liberals sort of trying to find some other way to represent a public interest that is not being represented by the agencies themselves.
So it's in chapter two that we meet sort of your main characters who you alluded to earlier here. There's Rachel Carson, there's Jane Jacobs, and there's Ralph Nader. And of course, Nader gets the most attention throughout the book, partly because he's living and working in the United States throughout your whole period here. Beyond their fame and their authoring of influential bestsellers, what's similar about them? And I also wonder, is it mere coincidence that, these are all characters that also might pop up in an environmental history survey course or in a textbook? Is the environmental dimension of them purely just accident, or is there something kind of meaningful about that?
Well, that's a great question. I mean, I really use Carson Jacobs and Nader in the early in the book to set up the intellectual challenge to the New Deal order, and they're all authors of blockbuster books. And they have a lot of commonalities in the sense that they all have, writing backgrounds of various kinds. And they had connections to government in different ways, but they end up being quite critical of the government agencies. And so I see them as intellectuals who are articulating this critique of the New Deal order. And they all blame the agencies and the people running the agencies for being too close to business or having their own terrible ideas, whether it's Robert Moses or the U.S. Department of Agriculture with pesticides or the car companies and the traffic safety agencies. And Nader calls this a constellation the great power with no challengers. And I see that sort of as a metaphor for the New Deal liberal order. And they are saying that citizens have to rise up and challenge this constellation of power. And it's not a coincidence at all, of course, that I'm interested in the environment and the book leans towards the environmental characters. But it's not a coincidence that they would all be in environmental history surveys because they all are a part of the citizen movement that's attacking the agencies. And one of the main things that the citizen movements were attacking agencies for were the developmental plans of the post-war period, whether it's highways or pesticides or redevelopment plans. And so the environment is an area where a lot of what's going on is happening related to public goods like clean air and clean water and that citizen activism. There's no clear entity responsible for protecting those interests. And so it is a understandable area where citizens would rise up to try to protect those interests. So I bring them all together in the beginning of the book, but actually Nader is the transitional figure there, which and Carson and Jacobs don't continue through the book. Obviously, Carson dies at a young age, sadly, and Jacobs actually leaves the country to go to Canada. But Nader is distinctive because he then becomes an organizational entrepreneur and decides that he's going to kind of create all these nonprofits and bring all these young people into a movement. And so he's the transitional figure from the intellectuals to the nonprofit movement of the 70s. And that's kind of the important turn that happens in the late 60s with these, with Nader.
Yeah. And as you narrated Nader's career, it's just really astonishing. I understood the influence he had, but when you go through it year by year, it's really like the
busy guy, power, busy guy.
Yeah. Busy. And then the influence he was able to have, on Congress was really quite striking. In 1969, he assembles this task force, and I think also the stuff about, his allure to young lawyers, especially, I think, do you say that a third of Yale law students in 1 year?
A third of the Harvard Law School class, I think, applied to work for Nader to go do investigative work
just
for him.
unbelievable. But so in 1969, he assembles this first task force to investigate federal protections of health and safety of all kinds in this kind of developmental arm. And what's especially striking about its first report, which is on air pollution, is that it really just excoriated Senator Edmund Muskie, who probably had as an impressive a record of environmental action as anyone in Congress at that time. And he was certainly invested in his environmental image, looking forward to the 72 presidential campaign. Why did Nader want to attack Muskie? Why attack Muskie? And what does that reveal about Nader's theory of power, as you call it?
Yeah, that's great. So I guess the first report was on the Federal Trade Commission, that was successful, and then he invites a whole group of people to come down and they investigate clean air, clean water, pesticides, and he kind of sees this task force model as an approach, and the students and professionals go rummaging around in the agencies, and there's a description of them like looking under the couches and finding the secrets. But I think that the attack on Muskie is really telling because Muskie is a big liberal who's seen as a big, tremendous environmentalist. And Nader and John Esposito, who's one of the lead writers of the Vanishing Air report, really call out Muskie and say this is all a lie, essentially. And it's part of the ambivalent relationship, I guess, of Nader and the public interest movement with the Democratic Party. And I think it symbolizes a lack of commitment to the party itself, the sense that they are outside and above the party and separate from it. And they have to hold that the party is as culpable. The parties are very similar. And Nader has also found success attacking attacking his friends. There's more success attacking your friends than your enemies, because your enemies don't give a crap what you think. And whereas your friends, Muskie, immediately after Nader's report came out, Muskie called a press conference and he had to defend himself, and it had a real impact on the Clean Air Act, resulted in it being much tougher than it would have been otherwise. And Nader and his team were involved in negotiating aspects of it. And Leon Billings, who was one of the Senate aides, he credited Nader for holding the Democrats' feet to the fire and making the bill tougher. So it had tremendous results. So it just shows the ambivalence of Nader and the public interest movement to liberalism and to the Democratic Party, that Nader would be launching this attack on Muskie, who was at that time trying to position himself to be the Democratic candidate in 1972. Nader was really going after the standard bearer for environmentalism. And at Earth Day, Muskie is out calling on the movement and celebrating environmentalism, and to go after Muskie like that contribute to his ultimately not being the nominee was significant, and that's a kind of an ambivalence towards the party. You asked about the theory of power, and I think that I have a chapter in the book about that, and I think the important theme on the theory of power has to do with power being insecure, and Nader talks about the idea that power of any kind can get too comfortable, can be corrupted, and can become oppressive. And so his idea of the citizen movement was that it would hold all the different kinds of institutions of power in society. It would help them be insecure and therefore more accountable and more accountable to the public interest.
And that's that chapter especially looks at why Nader was not. Not aloof to the lives and the threats on workers, but often opposing labor unions because of
because that's a real question for thinking about the public interest movement. So two questions that I think are worth asking about these liberals is, one is, why not try to take over the Democratic Party and take over the government? So that would be one question. And then the other is, why not operate through traditional labor unions? And what they did instead was create this array of small nonprofit organizations to watch over all these institutions. And the labor union that story, I got very interested in that, the story of the United Mine Workers and Jock Jablonski, who gets murdered by the head of the president of the United Mine Workers, Tony Boyle. And Nader had been involved in encouraging Jablonski to run, and then Jablonski gets murdered, and the murder of Jablonski is in many ways, it's very symbolic of the potential for corruption of power within the union, and so that is why the union democracy movement emerges, but also why the citizens movements have this ambivalent relationship to the unions themselves.
Yeah, and so in all these small organizations that start to spring up here and following in some ways Nader's lead here, many of them are just full of lawyers, and that becomes this big approach that we can talk about. And you title your chapter on environmental law firms, Sue the Bastards, which must have been fun to do. And that's a line, of course, that Environmental Defense Fund lawyer Victor Iannacone deployed as the organization's kind of unofficial motto. And it's important to your argument that we remember who the bastards were in their mind. I think we often think, oh, corporate polluters, right? But most often it's really government agencies that they're filing lawsuits against in this time. And so I wonder, why did mainstream environmentalism, get so litigious in the 70s, and why especially were its legal actions usually directed at the state?
Yeah, I think that's a great question, and that is why I chose that title, was to kind of the question of who were the bastards, and certainly industry still they also were the bastards, but when you go back and look at the case records of the Environmental Defense Fund and the Natural Resource Defense Council, Sierra Club Legal Defense Fund, virtually all of the litigation that they file is against government agencies, and that was for a couple of a few different reasons. One was that there wasn't really legal grounds for that. They didn't have a leverage point to file against the industries directly, and the agencies were playing a permitting role and a sort of guiding role that gave them leverage points. But that was also the agencies sort of allowing things that they thought were terrible ideas, whether it's highways or redevelopment projects or any number of different things, mines. And then the second aspect of this was that the government agencies were initiating projects themselves. They were very active, and you can think of someone like Robert Moses or the the Bureau of Reclamation or any number of these agencies were the Department of Transportation. So the government was a major target, and I think it was for so there were two aspects of this. One was the idea of the government being captured by industry, and then the second was the idea of government being sort of an independent bureaucracy that was. Had its own sort of narrow vision about the future and what should be done that these environmental lawyers didn't think represented the public interest. And the reason why they turned to litigation goes back to what I was saying about their attitude towards agencies. And what's quite interesting about it is the reversal that from the New Deal. In the New Deal, it was agencies over courts, and then now it's courts over agencies, and they see the courts as being the key. In the court, you can get a hearing, and you can the public interest can be affirmed and enforced. Whereas agencies, are the problem. So it was really seeing the agencies in some ways as responsible for the environmental crisis.
I think flagging that was just so helpful. I think to me to conceptualize this reversal, and that was really that's going to stick with me. And then we get to 76, and Carter is elected. First time we have a Democrat, in the White House in 8 years, and when his administration starts to staff up, we can see clearly how far the public interest movement had come in just those eight short years. And I wonder, what ways did Carter try to bring public interest Nader folks like that into the fold, and what limited his success in doing so?
Well, that's a great question, and you could say that the Carter years are in some ways the fulcrum for the book, and it's trying to sort of reassess Carter's what was Carter trying to do, Part of what I'm arguing is that Carter was trying to find a way to incorporate the public interest critique into governing, and he struggled to do that. He brought public interest lawyers, lots of people, into different agencies, EPA, transportation, really through into the Office of Management and Budget, elsewhere, and then the goal was to try to both. Have government act and be a positive force for implementing agendas and improving people's lives, and at the same time, Carter was passionate about reform, and he wanted to take into account the criticisms of government that had been articulated by the public interest movement over the previous 10 years, and show that government could both. Both act and be reformed and be like in a constant process of reform. And so he had some successes on this, but ultimately, I guess the argument of the book is that he failed to create a political strategy that would incorporate this duality. That it was too complicated, basically. And what we ended up with instead was something much simpler. Which was the Reaganites being against the government and for the market, and then the kind of post-Reagan liberals defending the government. And what got lost was this more complex thing that Carter was trying to implement, where liberals would both defend the government and criticize the government at the same time. And that, I think, that's really the dilemma that I'm trying to get at the book, and is the dilemma of the Carter administration. And I can get into more details about how that dilemma plays out.
Yeah, I wonder if you tell the story, it's very memorably. You have him at the signing ceremony on December 1980, where he has those two bills that kind of represent both parts of this game. You could talk us through that
one? Yeah. No, I think it's this fascinating moment in 1980 in December. So after he's lost the election, there's one day, I think it's the 10th or 11th, one morning, and Carter signs two bills. One is a Superfund law, and the other is the Paperwork Reduction Act. And so one way to think about this is that the Paperwork Reduction Act, the Superfund law was the last, environmental law of the 1980s. This was the decade, as Nixon said, this was going to be the decade of the environment, the 1970s, and that Superfund coming at the end of the right at the end of the administration was the final building block of this new regulatory state. And really, there wasn't much, after that. There are a few scattered major items over the next 30 years, but you could see this as as the end of that, and that paperwork reduction represented Reagan and the market, and we're going to constrain government and try to reform it. But I see it as something different. And if you go back and look at Carter's comments on it, you see what I was just trying to say, which is that Carter was actually passionate about both of these. It wasn't that Superfund was where his heart was and paperwork reduction was his concession. He believed, you know, passionately in government reform, and he alludes to like one of his most proudest days in his administration was when they got rid of 900 obsolete, you know, regulations. And he goes back and references his time in Georgia, consolidating agencies and reforming the government. And so what Carter was trying to do is to say that liberals could be both for Superfund, which ironically is like one of the great paperwork generating laws, you know, in the 1970s. And they could also be for paperwork reduction. So this duality that I'm trying to say, which is describe, which is the government being for the government for Superfund for action, and then critical of the government for paperwork reduction, to say that actually the government needs to be constantly improved and criticized and watched over.
That's great. I wonder if, before we move on to Reagan, who's waiting in the wings, obviously, in this conversation, I wonder if we could dwell on a couple of the limits of the vision of public interest groups and. One of them you touch on a lot in the book, which is you know, with mainstream environmentalism, it's very easy to say, you know, this group came enamored with kind of protecting places around where they lived and not where other people lived, right? And if it's this white middle class movement, and we see something similar happening here with public interest groups, even though it seems harder to imagine because they're talking about kind of making the government more responsive to the people in that way. And so you come back to this kind of again and again of where there was an opportunity to build a broader cross class movement that never came to be, and I wonder why you think that was.
Well, that's a great question about the 1970s, is trying to understand, you know, how you come out of the civil rights movement and you end up with this quite fragmented advocacy community around these very different issues. We could talk about that for a long time and offer different explanations for why that happens. But I think that one explanation for that or some different aspects of that. So one of the ironies of the environmental groups is that they are described today as being, very white. Why a more cross-class and multiracial movement didn't emerge during the 1970s? And I think that it's a real, it's a very interesting question going back, because you look at these environmental law groups that I am studying. And many of them are founded at the the height of the civil rights movement, and so it's a good question, like what's the relationship? And one of the things that I found was that the groups are really inspired by the civil rights movement, and they even name themselves kind of after the after the NAACP fund, legally law and litigation fund, you have the Environmental Defense Fund, the Sierra Club Legal Defense Fund. And so they're sort of modeled on that approach to public interest law, to sue the government and pursue litigation as a strategy. And many of the founders also had experience in the civil rights movement. They went down to the South, maybe just for a summer or some period of volunteering. But they were these are white lawyers who went down, and they were incredibly moved by their experience and inspired to be part of social change, and believing that the law could be about something more than working for corporations. Similarly, the Vietnam War was also deeply catalyzing for these lawyers in terms of their mistrust of the government and all that. So I go into that a little bit in the book. But the question you were asking is why is a more multiracial cross-class movement doesn't emerge? And there are efforts, right? We're working with farm workers, working with mine workers, working around highways. There are efforts, but ultimately it's not successful. I think there are several reasons. Again, a long possible topic. Sure. One of which is the focus on rights as an approach results in a segmentation of the issues. So you have a women's rights organization. You have environmental rights. You have poverty rights. You have racial justice organizations also splinter. You have a Mexican American, a Puerto Rican legal defense fund, a Mexican-American legal defense fund, African-American and Native American. You know, so there's just a proliferation of individuated approaches to seeking rights within a litigation-based system. And I think that there was they had success, tremendous success at the beginning. And so an example of that, I quote Jim Mormon, who's working for the Sierra Club Legal Defense Fund. I guess at that point he was working for the Center for Law and Social Policy, and they managed to stop the Alaskan pipeline, which is one of the largest infrastructure projects in American history at that point. And they're operating out of this dingy townhouse in D.C. The copier is like situated on the kitchen table, and he describes just being overcome, being in a daze, a fog of just like what had just happened. You know, here we've stopped the oil companies with this lawsuit. Intoxicating. I think they found it intoxicating, and they had tremendous early results. But I think that some of these folks, looking back, you know, people like Gus Speth, who helped found the Natural Resource Defense Council, have written that they went astray, and they didn't attend enough to movement building, and they got too overly enamored with litigation and the administrative process.
The other limit to their vision that I wanted to call attention to comes really from the book I finished just before yours, which is Jonathan Levy's Ages of American Capitalism, this sort of doorstop survey of American history of American capitalism. And when he gets to Nader and public rights, he harkens back to the same portrait of the New Deal that you laid out at the beginning here, that we had a developmental arm and a regulatory arm. And he said, by the time we get to the Carter years, thanks to Nader and others, the regulatory arm was really emboldened and it was kind of off to the races, but the developmental arm had really kind of fallen away. And it was at least in there, it was kind of not part of their vision of this. And I think to quote him here, he says, that this movement had nothing much to say about the dollar crisis or corporate investment and disinvestment at home or abroad or inflation. Is that a fair characterization? And kind of why would they be kind of aloof from these things that not only, I mean, maybe they're in the weeds, but they're also in the headlines at this time, right?
Yeah, well, I think the movement was quite antagonistic to a lot of the sort of core aspects of economic growth and economic development, and was exploring economic alternatives. This is more from, I talk about this kind of stuff in the bet. Mm-hmm. Small is beautiful, soft energy paths, limits to growth. There's a real critique of the use of applied science and technology in the post-war period, and there's lots of justification for how that went astray. But there was a sense of one, that those things were sort of corrupting, not interesting, not their domain. They didn't want to be involved in that, but also that there were these alternatives. And I think it's not until the end of the 90s that you start to see the environmental movement returning to trade agreements and getting interested in the World Bank and the IMF and seeing that, environmental things are intertwined with all these other economic things, and we need to broaden our definition of what the environment is to include other things.
Yeah, yeah. And every great book that I read has one thing that I'm embarrassed not to have known. And the one here is that Barry Commoner ran for president in 1980. I don't know how I didn't know that. That was very striking.
Well, it wasn't the most successful.
Well, sure. But rhetorically, I mean, the campaign also sounded, it was sounding a lot of the same notes that Nader will sound 20 years later when he runs in the second time for the Green Party.
That's quite striking.
How do we understand that? Why did he run for president? How did it fit into that election, which becomes really important?
Well, I mean, I think it was part of the left, an environment, a critique of Carter, and that's part of what I'm getting at is the public interest movement. There was a sort of an unwillingness to come to terms with the compromises that Carter might have to make in order to stay in power and to exercise power. And there was a lot of dissatisfaction with what Carter was doing. And rather than sort of rally around Carter and try to get him another term, instead, many people, they flocked to Kennedy as an alternative in the primary. They flocked to Anderson in the general election. And then also, people like Commoner ran under a New Citizens Party. And Commoner, Nader didn't want to run for office at that time. So Commoner, if he wanted to, I think he probably would have been the first choice. I don't have details on, evidence of that, but he had been talked about as a candidate since the early 70s. But, you know, but Commoner echoed many of his themes, talking about Tweedledee and Tweedledum. You know, yeah. The Republican and Democrat parties are very similar. And he criticized Carter, said he shouldn't run again. You know, it was a citizens' movement to, you know, attack both of the major parties, seeing them both as more the same than different.
Totally. So, okay, so Commoner loses, Reagan wins, is the way we always tell that story. But, you know, in the cartoon version of this history, the New Deal in regulatory order is kind of humming along, and then a suddenly powerful conservative movement comes off the sidelines and dismantles it. Now, your book really makes plain that there was a substantial liberal attack on the New Deal order that predated the rise of the right. But even more than that, what I was surprised by, and I knew the premise of the book, what I was surprised by is that, you know, sprinkled throughout, we have moments when conservatives actually adopt the public interest group tactics of these, you know, self-critical liberals. And you even detail how Nader and Reagan, in your words, sounded a surprising number of common themes. So how did conservatives parallel the public interest movement? And then where, of course, did the two diverge?
Well, I mean, I think that the many conservatives, you know, picked up on the criticism of the agencies and of regulation as problematic, and you know, liberals like Nader were criticizing the role of federal regulation as not serving the consumer. Conservatives might have been more interested in liberating the companies, the industries, but they joined forces in the late 70s in the deregulatory movement that actually starts before Reagan. And I think historians have written about this plenty, but I think the broader public often forgets that deregulation started under Carter and then continued under Reagan, and the deregulation under Carter was a great liberal pride that they had accomplished it. And you know, Tom McCraw writes about this in Prophets of Regulation, you know, the changing ideas about regulation. And again, I mentioned Dick Vitor's work as well. But this period of time going from the 20s and 30s to the 70s, there is now a reversal of attitude towards regulation. So that's, those are some of the common themes of seeing, but they diverge in that, Nader and the public interest groups, you know, they want more government. They want more active government that represents what they see as the public interest. The Reaganites want less government for the most part, although that's, you know, complicated. But they they talk about wanting government to get out of the marketplace, and they tout this so-called free market. And they're very opposed to what's called the social and environmental regulation of the early 70s, which they see as very oppressive to industry. Whereas that's sort of the pride and joy of Nader and others. You know, that was what they had accomplished. There's a sharp disagreement in that. And then I think Reagan, the Reagan folks come in and they are so hostile to the actual practice of government that they then actually, ironically, kind of derail the reform movement, which is one of the great ironies of the Reagan period, is that they derail government reform because they are so threatening to the very mere existence and operation of government. So that then pushes all these liberals who previously were attacking the government. Now they're in this full blown defense of the government. And that's kind of the stalemate that we end up following Reagan, is that liberals get pushed to defense. Republicans have this critique, and it's a very simplistic view of the whole thing.
Yeah. By my count, you conducted, 25 oral history interviews during your research? And I wonder that, you know, beyond what you gleaned from those interviews to put in the book and to kind of narrate the events here, how did those folks, you know, seem to think of the legacy of their work in this era?
Well, I think there's a lot of pride in things that they accomplished. You think about clean air and clean water and all sorts of different kinds of rights that were represented. And they also took action representing. It's a very idealistic movement about trying to represent the public, represent groups that hadn't been represented before. But I think there's also some sense that they were overly reliant on a sympathetic judiciary. And when the judiciary turned, all of a sudden the rug got a little bit pulled out from under them. And so that meant that their approach was less successful than they had hoped. As I mentioned, you know, people like Gus Speth, who's written a lot about this recently, acknowledged that the emphasis on inside the Beltway sort of regulatory tactics didn't build a broader social movement and political movement. And I think over the last 15 years, or I don't exactly know where you would pin it exactly, but there's been an interest in a rediscovery of politics, a rediscovery of communications, a rediscovery of of social movement building, and the sense that litigation is not by itself is not going to be a successful strategy. Although I would note, I guess that the Trump years, you know, really brought back public interest law as you know, a leading edge of the resistance. You know, with the ACLU and others, you know, suing the Trump administration, trying to block all sorts of stuff, and that I think resonates between the founding of the public interest movement during the Nixon years, and then its flourishing under the Trump administration.
There's this heavy reliance on the courts, and then there's also, you know, in this period, there's also this kind of question that keeps lurking. That's, you know, who gets to say what the public interest is, right?
Yeah.
And you show that conservatives are saying, you know, because you could say that, you know.
Well, I mean, that's what, you see that. Well, you have all these, you have groups like the Mountain State, you know, James Watt founds the Mountain States Legal Fund, and you have other public interest law groups that get funded by the Koch brothers and Koch and others to litigate. And now they got a sympathetic judiciary, and we're seeing some of that play out. So, so it turns out that the, you know, the public interest, the ability of citizen groups to represent the public interest is not one that they can sort of control who gets to claim that mantle or use those tools. And I think one thing that's very interesting right now, and maybe I'll get a chance to write about it, though, is the liberal attack on these folks and what they accomplished in the 70s and kind of blaming it for many of our problems today, whether it's housing, climate, our inability to build, you know, transmission lines or wind farms or solar, and saying that it's the problem was that we overly empowered citizen groups and we disempowered the government, and we need to go back. So I think there's, you know, some really interesting questions there related to current debates about infrastructure and the politics of infrastructure that you know, that we need to explore.
Yeah, that was actually my last question, because I was curious whether you know immersing yourself as you have in the very messy 70s, if it's changed how you look at politics today. Especially, you know, would you say that having all these small interest groups kind of as part of this sort of new tripartite structure where it's business, government, and not labor, but business, government, and interest groups, does that make it easier to stop things than to start things? Is it easier to not stop the government from doing things than to actually launch big projects when we look forward to things like, you know, climate remediation and things like that we need?
Yeah, I mean, I think the whole movement was designed around stopping the government from doing things. And so I think they would see that, you know, that was success, was stopping highways, stopping dams, stopping, redevelopment projects, stopping the spraying of pesticides. So, you know, that's success, I guess, in a lot of ways. But now, people are turning to the government and saying, hey, actually, we want them to do big things. We need to build these transmission lines. We need to build offshore wind farms. We need to build. I've been seeing recent commentary that's been very critical of the National Environmental Policy Act, NEPA, and blaming NEPA for all sorts of different things, or state level NEPA, state NEPAs. I think that's quite striking, because NEPA was the great success of this early movement in saying that actually that by creating the environmental impact statement, that requirement that you would have reviews of federal projects, so that was a great accomplishment, and now it's being seen as the villain, and I think that just raises questions about liberalism, about what is NEPA need to be jettisoned, or can it be somehow rethought? And I think, I've been trying to talk a little bit about infrastructure recently, and I think the key there, maybe, I was just saying, Biden has this phrase, build back better, and the key there is really on the better, because if we're going back to building back, the way that they were building in the 60s and 70s, I think you're going to see a lot of the same opposition, much of it, very well justified. And you can see that emerging around pipeline construction in Minnesota, the Dakota Access Pipeline, the Keystone Pipeline. Those are all resistance movements to stop big infrastructure. At the same time, people are calling for other kinds of big infrastructure to be built as being essential. So I think the better. We have to find some way to retain some oversight of these government programs and plans. but without completely paralyzing the government. And that really is the dilemma of, you know, the liberals face.
Can liberals find a way to do nuance better than Carter did, right? Because it just
looks, it's challenging. It's hard.
And it looks so easy for Reagan to run against it. Right? It looks so easy.
It's a lot easier on both sides. It's a lot easier to just defend, and it's a lot easier to just, just oppose. And how do you do something more complicated?
Well, yeah, like I said at the top, an extremely timely book to sit with this history and think about all of its complexities. I hope you're very busy then talking to people today about it for the near future. When your schedule, if your schedule ever opens up a little bit, are there future projects you have in mind that you want to share at this point?
Well, I'm figuring out the next direction. One project I'm exploring right now is to go back to some materials I collected actually as part of my first project, but they have to do with lawyers. But this case, it's lawyers operating overseas in their 20s and 30s in the Philippines and South America, and working on trying to sort of facilitate oil company extraction. So these are oil company lawyers who are trying to involved in rewriting property laws and constitutions to as sort of the leading edge of empire, I guess. So I'm exploring that a little bit. I don't know whether we'll see whether it becomes more than an article, but it's a new project that I'm working on.
Well, I can tell listeners if they're resistant to reading a book about lawyers, I can promise you should try one by Paul Sagan first. This one is very compelling. The book again is Public Citizens: The Attack on Big Government and the Remaking of American Liberalism. Its author, my guest, is Paul Sagan. Its publisher is W.W. Norton, and you should go snag your copy now. Paul, thanks so much for your time and for this book.
Thanks, Brian. Enjoyed the conversation.